Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. As soon as the past chair gets done chatting it up, we'll get started here. Thank you. We do not have a quorum at the moment, but I would like to get started. Would like to acknowledge our guests in the balcony, or whatever we call those places. The Teamsters are with us today. Welcome, guys. Yeah! We're glad you're here. So we'll be hearing from them a little later on. But before that, you're the warm-up act.
We're just here to warm
up. Mr. Commissioner, we'd like to welcome Commissioner Zelli and Tracy Hatch. Please introduce yourself for the record and go ahead with your presentation.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair Torkelson. I'm Charlie Zelli, Commissioner of the Department of Transportation. And I'm being joined by Tracy Hatch, who is our Deputy Commissioner and Chief Financial Officer, Chief Operating Officer. I normally don't speak for Tracy. She won't let me do that much longer. But I just want to say a couple of opening words and then get deep into our presentation. We're going to be presenting the governor's budget for transportation, particularly as it relates to MnDOT, and it's a multimodal a budget. It's not just highways and bridges. Although I have to say, we have really evolved this department over the past 4 years, and I am going to be talking about the funding deficiencies and what's needed and the plan to go forward over the next 10 years. But I have to say, it is as much about efficiency and effectiveness as it is about anything else. And I'm going to be talking about the next 10-year plan of increased funding with increased revenue. But then Tracy Hatch will be getting into more of the operational requests from our existing sources of funds, which we project over the next biennium. And just a word, somebody just mentioned that Tracy and I work well together. The Chief Financial Officer did not report directly to the Commissioner when I came in, and we redid the alignment, and it is really important that we actually, not only do we have an adherence toward the numbers, we've made it one of our primary goals is to understand and track and to make sure that the Minnesotans' dollars are being spent in the best places. And we're going to get into a few of the things we're doing in that regard. But a chief financial officer does more than just do the books, actually helps direct and understand strategically how we can deploy those funds. So that's why we often sit side by side. I also have to say that I am not an engineer. But you know what? MnDOT has a lot of them. I have managed an asset business for 30 years. I understand what it takes to become effective and manage organizations appropriately. So I come with an expertise in management. And that's something I think MnDOT has done well to improve. And we're always looking at ways to improve that. We're actually celebrating our 100-year anniversary of this year. The highway department began in 1917, so it was gravel roads, and we've evolved quite a bit since then. I have to say the two really important points I've talked about is that financial efficiency and prudence. We actually are counting as part of our revenue that we're going to use for deploying funds over the next 10 years. But also the other important point is that we've made a and currently really working on engaging with the public more effectively. So it's not just sitting in our little box by ourselves. We're doing more and more to become externally focused, working with local communities, local stakeholders, users of the system, and local governments, including elected officials. So we might be able to talk more about how we've changed our engagement practices. I say that because this idea of the $6 billion gap in the state system over the next 10 years didn't kind of come from really engineers or a finance department. It took quite a bit of work with our planners and our experts in evaluating both asset management, pavements, bridges, but also what it is that communities that we serve really want and value. But the driving force, of course, is the deterioration of the system. We have to not only maintain and improve what we have, but we know that there are strategic expansion points, new lanes, new interchanges. So if Minnesota is going to continue to have the quality of life and the prosperity we enjoy, we have to address them, and we don't have the funds to do it. So I think everybody collectively understands that we're undercapitalized. I just want to kind of briefly go through what those big elements are, and then we'll talk about the funding resources and then turn it over to Tracy. Pavements actually is...
Commissioner, I'm just going to interrupt you for a second. I now have a quorum for my meeting, so I'm going to officially call the meeting of the House Transportation Finance Committee to order. And Representative Johnson, do you have a motion?
Yes, I move to that we approve the February 28th minutes.
Johnson moves that we approve the February 28th minutes. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Minutes are approved. Please go ahead, Commissioner. By the way, Commissioner, your highway department started only 39 years after my great-grandfather organized his farm. So you're old, but you're not that old.
Oh, okay. Well, I know a certain bus company that's celebrating its 100th year in a couple of years from now. So, you know, there's a great legacy to Minnesota business.
Yeah.
Well, I was talking about pavements is probably one of the biggest drivers for our undercapitalization. It really requires constant maintenance, but it also requires refurbishment and replacement. The biggest metric that we not only think is a good idea, we're working much better to measure, is to have a remaining service life. That is how many more years with existing traffic patterns these pavements will last. And our asset management engineers have a pretty good idea, and the way the current trends are going, there'll be much more significant deterioration in the years ahead. Bridges are the other factor. We think the bridges are in actually pretty good shape around the state of Minnesota currently, but the forecast, because of the reduction in available funds, it will diminish in a matter of a few years. The funding will require us to be more efficient by doing the proper preventive maintenance and rehabilitation at the right time. Of course, mobility is very important. We think about mobility needs across the entire state. The Twin Cities have particular needs because of the congestion that's mounting. We have, and I won't go through all the famous projects, but many know them. We want to prioritize extending the MinPass system. These are both transit lanes and high-density corridors, which have been, I think, very effective at driving more mobility, more choices, more people through corridors, not just vehicles. Safety is always a metric that we measure. We look for what I call high return investments. That means for the relative little cost, we're able to get some big safety improvements. High tension cable medians are a good example. I've got a lot of questions over the past few years. Why do we put those little medians in the middle of the grassy area on one side of a major corridor? I've now had more and more, some of them elected officials and legislators, have come up to me with stories about family members whose lives, including the person sitting next to me, who were actually saved by those small investments. Rumble strips are another example. We've actually pioneered and got a national award for what we refer to as a mumble strip. Mumble strip is we don't want to disrupt the neighbors as much, but we actually get the effectiveness of getting a shaking in the steering wheel. So we're proud of some of what we've done in that regard. Mobility isn't only just, again, in the metro area. We have the interregional network, which is part of our Corridors of Commerce program, as well as our Greater Minnesota Transit. We actually have bicycle infrastructure and pedestrian infrastructure as part of our plan. This is always done in conjunction with other projects, local governments generally, but also sometimes just what MnDOT's doing. It actually is part of our efficiency. It is not just good for health and good for mobility. It's what people want. It's what people want on the Main Street environment, what people want on the trail network. And we're seeing this in Greater Minnesota and in urban environments. We have funds in this plan that will actually help small cities meet the ADA requirements that we are doing. In other words, there's a local match often for a small town. We will come in on a project, and it sometimes starves a local community. We actually now provided a funding source to kind of help Minnesota towns kind of meet the what is a, actually a federally mandated requirement. Roadside infrastructure is something we've never talked in as much about, but we actually have funds in this $6 billion gap for the state system. Actually the money isn't just about roads and bridges. It's the roadside culverts. It's the signs. Sometimes it's the supporting capacity for MnDOT to maintain the system. In other words, this idea of the shortfall is not to say, well, we only talk about the construction program. We have shortfalls in other places. Try to be as comprehensive as we can, because when we can be efficient with our operations, we want to make sure that we're being smart about all of our investments, whether it's a aluminized pipe going underneath the road that will last four times longer than the galvanized pipe that's already eroded. We want to be smart about what we're building. When I mentioned the local partnerships with communities across the state, our Main Street program has some of the same goals we're doing in the metro. It's the idea that livability and commerce along a Main Street, even though it's a state highway, can actually accommodate both increased traffic, freight traffic, and through traffic signaling, through sidewalks, lighting, it can be a more inviting place for communities. And those Main Street projects that we have done over the past, past 2 years, have met with some great local success. And I think part of it is our engagement to include not just the local government, but the chambers of commerce, the citizens, the retail businesses become aligned over a common goal. I want to just talk about the funding components. This should come as no surprise, but the governor, as you know, is recommending essentially what he's been recommending over the past 2 years. It is the 6.5% gross receipts tax on fuel. People said that's a lot like a fuel tax. That's because it is. It's a fuel tax, no question about it. There actually is a kind of a floor on that roughly $2.5 per cost of fuel. So you can say that's roughly a 16-cent fuel tax. It's really the main driver. Registration fees are included. For the state highway system, $2 billion in trunk highway bonds. Two new elements this year in the governor's budget is the $10 surcharge on the annual vehicle registration, as well as a $10 surcharge on the title transfers. I will get into more details about that in a minute. And of course, we've already committed and consistently committing to gain in efficiencies 15% of new revenue, because we think that's a pretty good target, that with increased revenue, we're able to make the investments that will save us money, and we can track what that savings will be. This is a way to lay out the actual dollars. This will be adjusted again from the forecast we just heard. It's pretty close. We think it might go up a little, Tracy says. But this is a pretty good number to look at. And you can see that the registration taxes are phased up. The way the projection here works is the fuel tax portion would be effective on October 1st, so it's not a full year. But then it kind of gets into a full year. And this is what really addresses the full $6 billion need for the trunk highway system. But I haven't mentioned that it does provide substantial amount of resources for local, county, and for municipal state aid needs, as well as the 5% set aside flex fund, which I'll talk to in a minute, plus the DNR. What will we get? The outcomes are pretty clear. We do have a much more detailed Next 10, specifics, including an illustrative 10-year mix of projects based upon our asset models, which you may have seen in the past, but we're happy to share those. And I won't get into them today. But as you know, or as you've been told, this will address 1,700 miles of roadway, which otherwise would deteriorate. It addresses 235 bridges in the state, as well as the a very fairly robust Corridors of Commerce program over the next 10 years. This will not solve every project that is being proposed. This is by no means is the world-class, oh my God, we'll do anything. This takes hard choices and hard programming, but we believe it's what is required to keep our state competitive and prosperous as it is now. Again, the funding for counties, towns, and townships, $2.4 billion over 10 years, would really be needed, and we know by no means does that solve all the local road and bridge deficiencies, but it's a big start. We think that this is an appropriate funding because in the greater course of people's, Minnesotans' lives, we don't think it materially affects, even though it really is a tax. It is based, it is a user fee bias. It is dedicated to transportation and into the, particularly the highway user fund by the Constitution. And we know we can count on it, so it's sustainable. We know we can plan for these projects over the course of many years, which it sometimes takes in order to be smart about it. And also, it is something that will allow us to gain the efficiencies and the prudence that, because it's sustainable over time, that we have been describing. The advantage of having this gross the sales on tax on gross receipts is that it is an inflation buffer. It's fine if it stays at 16 cents, but if costs are going up, our transportation costs go up. There are much of it, construction and asphalt and fuels are tied to, the price of motor fuels. So this is a mechanism that has already been deployed in 12 other states recently. Other states have had just straight gas taxes, we actually think there's some merit in this technique or this tool. The part that's new, the vehicle surcharges, this $10 surcharge provides $57 million a year. We found a number of areas which were not addressed in the Republicans' plan that we've really felt should be addressed. Greater Minnesota Transit, the bike and ped needs through safe routes to schools used to be federally funded. That is not true anymore. It is a very popular program, and it really has had both a safety advantage and also a health advantage for many communities. We actually are offering this EPA funds for local roads. I mentioned that before. And you can see additional aid for all towns and cities. So we think that this is an appropriate and a deployment of funds to needs that weren't otherwise addressed from previous governor's proposals. So this is the big picture about funding. It is not just a $6 billion need for this 12,000-mile state system. It's $12 billion if you consider both build-out of the Metropolitan Transit, but also the counties and townships. So this kind of gives you the larger picture and how the money flows to the different funds, different needs. Now we're turning it over to Tracy. We'll get into some of the specific areas.
Thank you, Commissioner. You covered the increased revenues, except you didn't mention the 1.25% to 1.5% on registration fees. Is Ms. Hatch going to cover that in her presentation?
No, but the registration fees and the fuel tax and the bonding is what are the different elements that that bring us to this funding source. So this 8.9 billion is really comes from a variety of sources of funds. So the registration fee, maybe we should go back here. Before you can see it here on the second line. It's starts at 21 million because it hasn't been deployed until October 1st, but it it ramps up and it and as part of his proposal. Is that it's kind of graduated in over 3 years, 4 years.
Thank you. I'm going to ask members to hold questions. We're already over 20 minutes into the meeting, and we have some work to do. So, Ms. Hatch, if you could go through these slides as expediently, it would be very beneficial, and we'll try and get some questions in at the end.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I'd be happy to do that. May I just take a moment to orient you to some materials that I think you have in front of you. You should have the PowerPoint. I see that you do. You likely should have a document that looks like this. This is just a succinct way of putting all of the requests together. And then you should have also a set of four documents that we refer to them as one-pagers, a little bit more explanation about some of the particular requests, and I'll touch on those as we go. So the slide here on slide 13, you see it on the screen. It's maybe easier to look at in your handout. This just lays out the general operating budget requests. These are requests that we're asking for with current revenue sources, and these are basically the standard kind of operating requests that the department would present to you at any legislative session. So these represent the current needs in the department on the operating side. I'm going to go through these first. I'll do it as quickly as I can, and then we also have a set of rail requests as well that we'll wrap up with. So the first request, you may have heard more about this if you're in other committees and have other agencies that you work with. Cybersecurity, this poses a huge risk actually for not just the department, but the entire state. In fact, last Friday, there was a cybersecurity summit hosted by the Minnesota IT Services, and there's several of the legislators were there, and I think just talking to everyone who attended, it was really, really fascinating, but also really scary to see the needs in the realm of cybersecurity and just how attacks and so forth have ramped up and how clever the criminal element is getting. And so we have noticed over the last 2 years in particular that there is a significant need on behalf of the department to get in a better position with regard to our IT applications. So what we're asking for here is funding that would effectively be $10.5 million in fiscal 18, $9.35 million in fiscal 19, and then an ongoing base request of $6.15 million. So it's a mix of some one-time, a big one-time infusion with a base element. We really have a lot of old data systems, a lot of old applications that really there's no way to secure them on an existing platform. As you probably know, the entire network is vulnerable if one application is vulnerable and susceptible. I know if you're on the state government committee, I think you've been briefed by Minute more in detail about the state's cybersecurity risk, and it's something that we don't talk about specifics in public because of the nature of the risk, but we have a number of applications that we really do need to get replaced, upgraded, or integrated into the system that currently can't be. I could give you a lot more detail on that if you're interested.
Representative Howe just cannot resist the urge to ask a question, even though I want him to.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just leave it to me to break the mold. But I was waiting for is the whether Minute was involved in, and so that's Minute's recommendation. Is Minute going to be doing these? And is this going to be a recommendation separate from Minute, or is Minute's recommendation, is this included in Minute's proposal, so therefore it doesn't need to be in your budget, but it's in Minute's budget?
Ms. Hatch.
Mr. Chair, Representative, that's a great question. No, it is not included in Minute's proposal. Minute is carrying enterprise-wide proposals and things that would impact the enterprise at large and basically infrastructure pieces. And many agencies that put forward requests this year, ours is specific to applications that are at the DOT that we are responsible for financially. Minute, however, is very involved. We've worked with them extensively on this. They're in agreement with the number and what we need to do. In fact, at a meeting not long ago, the state chief information security officer actually pointed out in a gracious way that I followed up with him afterwards, and I found out that, in fact, MnDOT has some significant vulnerabilities because of the old applications that we have that actually raise the significant risk score for the entire enterprise. So they are very much in the loop on this. This is a joint effort, but this is our specific request. Any request you see for a minute is in addition to this.
Representative Lucero, very quickly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'll make this quick. So in regards to what the point you just made, that Minute has their own strategy to secure those technologies that are underneath their purview, then within your department, you have a strategy that you formulated to upgrade, et cetera, to secure those applications, technologies within your purview. So my question is, I've seen it many times in the industry where you have an umbrella organization developing strategy, making arrangements with vendors, and then you have a division or some other department that has a similar need, but then uses a different vendor. So there isn't synergy between the technologies or the processes, et cetera, that are being used there. So if you're looking at this within your department, are you working with at least working with Minute to ensure that there is synergy to capitalize on economies of scale, et cetera?
Ms. Hatch.
Mr. Chair, Representative, absolutely. In fact, we did not develop these just in a vacuum on the MnDOT side. We have Minute personnel that actually are within the department. They're embedded in the department. And I work very closely with the deputy at Minute. We're all in sync on this. And in fact, all procurement, all purchasing of any IT goes through Minute anyway. So there would not be a situation where we would hire a vendor, because we can't anymore. So we would not be hiring an IT vendor, for example. That would be in some sort of opposition to the direction that Minute is heading. Very much in lockstep. Minute is focused on the broader, again, enterprise-wide solutions, things like data centers and backbone infrastructure for the whole state, desktop infrastructure, things like that. And then the individual departments, if they have individual applications that are unique to that department, the individual department is responsible financially for those applications. And of course, all of the work takes place with and through Minute. They do all of the procurement, and in fact, the bulk of the work here will be done by Minute staff and or contracted out through Minute to the private sector.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Please go ahead.
The next request, I mentioned this one in our meeting last week briefly, but this is to establish some statutory language for us regarding our snow and ice service. Snow and ice is such a it's a flagship activity for us, as you might be aware, but it is also one of the most expensive and least predictable activities that we do. In one given year, we don't know if we're going to have a $60 million snow and ice season or we're going to have a $140 million snow and ice season. And they actually can swing that wide. We've had that happen from one year to the next, a $50 million swing. And so what ends up happening is we hold back on spending on our other maintenance activities and our other critical needs because we're just not sure what money we're going to need to get through that second snow and ice season of the biennium. So what we're asking for here is for some statutory language that would allow us to establish our budget for snow and ice, and we would plan to establish that in the $65 to $7 million a year range. We would commit to funding whatever the snow and ice needs are, plus or minus 10% of that. And then if we get into kind of financial trouble, if you will, if we exceed that 110%, we would like the statutory authority to be able to pull from the fund balance rather than kind of holding our other maintenance activities hostage until we get through that second season. It would allow us to plan so much better. It would allow us to collaborate so much better, to make purchases earlier in the fiscal year, particularly that second fiscal year of the biennium. So often we hold back on buying things like cable median barrier materials, patching materials, paving materials, signs, things that we would use for our striping crews, even equipment. And you'll see a request in here in a minute regarding equipment. And so we end up just holding all of those procurements back and then rushing at the end of the biennium to get those through if there's money left over. And so this would really help us to be more efficient and to streamline our operations. And Mr. Chair, I'm only going to elaborate on just these first couple, and then I promise I'll go really quick. Workforce optimization. You do have a one pager in your handout regarding workforce optimization. It shows it at the top, and it shows kind of pictures of three stick people. This is effectively what I referred to last week as well. There were some questions about our ability to hire staff and the department's ability to retain staff or versus having staff that go to cities and counties or the private sector. So the short version of a complicated story, and I would love to talk with you more about it if you're interested, is that what we're referring to here is workforce optimization really would sort of reset our staffing on program delivery as well as our staffing for operations and maintenance. Our operations and maintenance staff are those staff that you see at work doing plowing in the winter and mowing and do help out with some construction activities in the summer. We have a significant challenge hiring those staff, particularly in the wintertime. As I mentioned, the labor pool that used to be readily available just seems to not be quite so readily available. This would allow us to have enough staff to have two staff assigned to a plow. In other words, we'd be able to run a 24-hour operation when we need to with those plows. It would also allow us to no longer have the reliance that we currently have on engineers and designers and technical folks that are on the program delivery side of the business. Right now, as I mentioned last week, we require plowing to be in those position descriptions. That also causes a significant hiring challenge for us as engineers and or those technical folks don't want to plow. Many of them would just really prefer not to. And so we're losing folks to the private sector where they don't have that requirement. In addition, we fall behind, and then we struggle to catch up with the designing and with getting projects ready for letting. So all winter long, we're at the mercy of the snow and ice season, again, in our staffing. And that effectively kind of holds our construction program and how quickly we get those out, as well as overtime we might pay as we have to catch up with those letting schedules through the spring. And so this is a really, really important activity for us. I know it might look like a big dollar amount. About $18 million of that $25 million would be for salaries and compensation. That's at a $60,000 a year total compensation. And then the remainder of those dollars would be used for materials and equipment that those staff would need. If you have more staff that are able to get out and do the work, you might need more equipment and materials to make that happen. So this it has significant benefits on every side of our operation, really important for us. And then again, I'm going to kind of move a little quickly so we have time for questions. This is a request, again, if you're seeing other agencies as well. This is a request you'll see from other agencies, our general operating pressures. This is where the base increases just have not kept up with the full impact of compensation, including some salaries, step increases, and including health care costs. We also had a pretty significant liability for the pension fund that we had to make sure to cover. So this would help us to catch up with that, and it would also help us to buffer the loss we have through inflation on commodities. We, as you might expect, go through quite a large number of commodities every year. This is federal funds that are available to the Trunk Highway Fund. It shows the PIRs, the Trunk Highway Fund request. These are all federal funds. It shows the PIRs, a Trunk Highway Fund request, just because unlike other agencies, we actually pulled the federal funds into the Trunk Highway. So, again, this would provide our $105 million that we need in fiscal 17, available through the end of the following biennium, through fiscal 19, and it would provide the federal funds for fiscal 18 and fiscal 19. I just want to be clear that these are not, these are funds we don't currently have state authority to spend, but they aren't brand new funds to the state. They are new funds to the state, but they are programmed already. So they aren't available really for programming. They're, I don't know what else to say. They're not spent yet because we can't legally spend them until we have your authority. But they are committed. They are committed on projects already in the queue. This is a base request. The next request here on slide 19 is a base request of $10 million. That would help to fund pavement preservation. I really think of this as an efficiency activity. A couple years ago, the legislature provided us with, I believe it was $10 million at that time, for pavement preservation, and we were able to really catch up on some of our pothole patching. If you were around then, you remember we had a significant freeze-thaw cycle that winter, and we had potholes just everywhere. This would help us to provide longer-term, more durable fixes on those pavement issues. One thing, for example, is mastic. So mastic is a relatively new product that's on the market that has significant duration, and it is a more expensive product, a product that we wouldn't generally be able to afford in our regular business, but with this additional funding, we would do more mastic, and it is so much more efficient. You send a crew out there once; it's good potentially for up to 3 years, rather than us going out multiple times in a season to patch the same hole. But again, when the materials are more expensive and resources are tight, it's hard to be doing the most efficient activity there. I mentioned last week a little bit about our buildings. We have over 1,000 buildings of some type, and those might be salt sheds, they might be truck stations, they might be the headquarters, they are our Minroad facility, fixed scale sites, rest stops, etc. And we are we've done a condition assessment over the last few years, and we have recognize that we have fallen woefully behind in our maintenance of those facilities.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're requesting a $17 million base increase to catch up and then maintain on a good schedule with those. I need to make two corrections on this slide. It's also stated incorrectly in the budget narrative. So the third bullet down, which is the first bullet under maintain critical statewide facilities, the $6 million for the facilities maintenance program, that is just an internal program, a one way that we separate the budget once it comes in, and that is not for projects less than $2 million. While that is actually for projects much less than $2 million, we typically spend that on things like upgrading an HVAC system in a facility. It might include fixing a garage door that gets backed into with a plow truck, things like that. Smaller, more local fixes that are left up to the districts for the most part. And then the next bullet where it says projects over $2 million, that's not accurate. It's actually for projects under $2 million. If projects are $2 million or more, we come to the legislature through a capital request and make that request directly. But these would be for replacement of things like a small truck station. We had the roof blew off a building, and we had to basically do a lot of structural work on a facility to have that repaired and put a new roof on. And so that's what we would take that out of. We call it our small capital program. And then you'll see we anticipate an increase of $250,000 next year and the following year for the lease of our current central office building right next door. Road equipment, as you may expect, we have a lot of different types of equipment, and that equipment operates best when it's within its optimum or standard life cycle as presented by the manufacturer. As it turns out, we have significant portions of our equipment that are outside of the optimum life cycle. In fact, I believe it was $13 million we spent this last year on equipment that's outside of its life cycle for repair and maintenance of that equipment. And so I look also at this as a significant efficiency for the department, that if we could have a little bit more funding that could help us catch up and keep up on the proper life cycle for some of this equipment, that would be significant. We often think of our plow trucks, and yes, plow trucks are a big part of this. When I first came to the department, I did a ride-along and found out that our mechanics were going to salvage yards looking for parts. And that's just not the proper way to maintain fleet. We have improved on that significantly over the last few years. We drove our plow fleet down from an 18-year replacement cycle. It should be 12. It was trending toward 20. It was at 18. We've driven that down to about 14 or 15 years right now, which is okay, but we'd like to push that down to 12. And then in addition to that, we just have a lot of other equipment, other vehicles, but we have skid steers and loaders and just all kinds of equipment throughout the state that that this would apply for. Intelligent transportation systems, you may have heard a lot about this in the media, in publications and journals. It's actually really a hot topic right now and getting hotter. One of the main ways that that we would deploy these resources, which would be a $4 million request, base request. You also do have a one-pager on this in your handout as well that goes into a little bit more detail. But this would effectively provide funding for us to gear up and stay abreast of the fast-paced implementation of things like connected vehicles and autonomous vehicles. It also would help us to provide more ITS technology in work zones as well as regarding our snow and ice operations to be able to be more efficient there. And would connect with our regional traffic management center, which is located in in Roseville, and then to actually develop some statewide incident and traffic management congestion in greater Minnesota as well.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair and others. I think the point here is not just what we read about autonomous vehicles or autonomous buses. This is where the vehicles are actually talking to the infrastructure. Mm-hmm. So you think about it as vehicle to vehicle, then vehicle to eye, V to eye, is how the infrastructure of the roadway is going to be able to manage traffic. So we think about, you know, what was previous generation traffic lights, which we use, ramp metering. Now it really is disruptive technology changing. It will allow us to actually manage traffic flows as just an example. You know, synchronized traffic lights. This is all the world that is changing quickly, and it's, you know, the future is kind of here, and we're going to kind of fall behind. So that's why we're jumping in.
I should mention briefly that on your one pager that's associated with intelligent transportation systems, there are two numbers that are incorrect. One number is at the very top. I think it's the first line. It refers to a $9 million request. That is incorrect. It's a $4 million request. And also at the very bottom, it refers to, I think, 28 FTEs. That number is incorrect as well. That number would be in the 3 to 4.5 FTE range. Three, four, or four and a half kind of range. The next request is to provide a sustainable, more sustainable funding source for our tribal training. The governor has an executive order, as you may be aware, for consultation and involvement with tribal communities. And we have developed, over the last few years, a wonderful, actually very robust training regarding interactions with tribal governments. And it has been attended by a lot of MnDOT staff, particularly managers, district engineers, and the like. And there's been a great deal of interest from other state agencies as well. And we have welcomed them into our trainings. There is a small per registrant fee that we charge. And many of those agencies are saying that they want to attend, but they find that they can't really spend more than that on those. They don't have the budget or the availability of funds to spend more than what we're currently charging, which is about $300 for the training. That $300 provides basically the food, facility, materials, and speaker fees for that specific training, but it does not help us to develop the training, create the curriculum, work with the University of Minnesota and tribal communities in the process. And so this funding would help us to do that, provide basically sort of the umbrella funding that would be able to provide the infrastructure for the training. This is $192,000 in fiscal 18, $218,000 in fiscal 19, and then a base request of $200,000 per year. I should also mention that a big part of what we're trying to do here is also to automate it and make it an online training that could be available to cities and counties as well. It is a tribal-to-tribal government relations training, and it would also allow us to have folks throughout the state participate without having the travel cost. So we're trying to automate that. Getting to the end of my list, here's the Working Capital Loan Fund. We currently have a small amount of funds. I believe it's about $413,000, some of which is federal funds, some of which is truck highway cash, in the Working Capital Loan Fund. And you do have a one-pager on this in your packet as well. It provides more detail. What we're asking for here is $1.5 million of general fund cash to support this as well. With the trunk highway rules and the federal rules, it gets very cumbersome. But the bigger issue is when there's a local city or county project that one of these disadvantaged businesses gets a bid for, they are not eligible for the current funding sources. And so the $1.5 million here would be a one-time request to fund the Working Capital Loan Fund with that flexible general fund funding source. That would support low-interest loans to these small businesses. I would also like to say that we had been doing this, and we actually, I believe, either have out just now or are just about to issue an RFP for another administrator for this program. We had previously administered this program for several years, and we've actually only had one default, which actually I think is a really, really good sign that the program really does work, but it really does need some both additional cash, and it also needs some flexible cash. The next item there is the Port Development Assistance Reappropriation. We had about $1.1 million of funding that was appropriated in the 2015 session. Those projects are underway, so one project in Red Wing, one project in Winona, and they're just not going to be completed and have those funds encumbered or spent by the end of this fiscal year, which means the funds would cancel. So what we're asking for here is that you would cancel that current appropriation and just reappropriate those dollars to us. So again, $1.1 million to finish those two port projects. This is a request that we've had the last couple of years from the from the governor, and this is to replace the two aircraft that we currently have that provides general aviation services to state agencies, to the governor, and to legislators as well to come out and look at projects and things like that with us. This is just sort of the next iteration. I know that you've heard a lot in the last couple of years. I believe DNR has had a request that was successful 2 years ago. DPS also received a purchase 2 years ago. I think there's another request from DPS today, right now. And then this is our request. So I'd like to be able to share a lot more information with you about this request, but I'd be happy to take follow-up questions or answer more. The short version is we have two aircraft. They're very old, and they're needing some pretty significant repairs. In fact, one of them needs an engine overhaul. That's about $350,000. Actually, needs two engine overhauls. It's scheduled. The first engine overhaul is scheduled either in fiscal 17 or fiscal 18, and then the other engine overhaul will need to take place in fiscal 19. Again, I could share more information with you, but in the interest of time, I'll move on. The State Airports Fund, this is a request from the State Airports Fund to increase our aeronautics office appropriation. This will be principally used to provide grants. The legislature 2 years ago provided a change to the statute for local match on aviation grants, and so we've seen a significant uptick in the number of requests, and so the fund can sustain this, and so we would like to increase the operating appropriation for the aeronautics office. As you see here, it has not been increased as a base increase in 20 years, so we'd really like to be able to help it to keep up with the demand that's taking place out there. And Mr. Chair, I know that that the presentation is taking longer than you had planned. Would you like me to continue with the rail requests?
Well, we are running short of time, and you have a choice. You can either finish or take some questions.
So the rail requests.
Nice choice.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for the option. I will speak quickly. We have several rail requests, not as many as what I just went through. We have a big department. There's a lot going on there. And so this request is to provide $800,000 in base funding from the general fund to support our freight rail area. There's currently a base funding of $256,000 in that account. That is just, we have just been so short. That is just not adequate funding for the amount of requests and the amount of activities that that rail area does. You'll notice there, I won't read them through, but there are a number of very important activities that are taking place there, and we simply don't have a funding source for that right now. We have the Minnesota Rail Service Improvement area. We're asking for a $1 million appropriation, base appropriation to help fund that activity and also to allow that activity does three things. One of those things is to provide right now low-interest loans to rail lines. And what we'd like to do is, in some cases that support economic development, convert or allow grants instead of low-interest loans. There's also a request for a $400,000 general fund base increase to our passenger rail program. That would be our operating increase ask. You may also recall that the governor had requested a $1 million capital GO bond request to support passenger rail as well. We currently have several safety inspectors, rail safety inspectors, four inspectors to be exact. And so this is a program that we would ask to hire up to five additional rail inspectors plus a program manager. These are funded from assessments on Class 1 and Class 2 railroads. And so that estimate for increase in the assessment would be about $615,000 in fiscal 18. We would also like to establish a rail safety account. We already have a rail safety account, and it's funded right now with $1 million a year from fines produced by the State Patrol. Thank you. And so right now $1 million goes into the rail account, and the remainder goes into the Trunk Highway Fund. This request is to move those funds from the going into the Trunk Highway Fund to go into the rail safety account to be able to do more activities related to rail safety. You see there sign replacements, closures, installing stop arms and gate arms where we can. So small safety projects. The governor is also requesting $32.5 million annual assessment on Class 1 railroads. That would fund highway rail grade crossings on these rail corridors, particularly grade separations. Those grade separations can cost anywhere from $10 to $30 million to do. And so in addition to that, any additional funds on an annual basis would be used to upgrade existing warning devices, to construct highway rail, to install gate arms and signalized systems where there is currently a passive system, and we think that this would provide significant safety benefit, particularly in Greater Minnesota. And then, in the interest of time, I won't go through these four, but these are not fiscal requests. These are kind of policy provisions that have a fiscal tie. I'm sure you've seen these before. I'd be happy to take questions on them. But there's basically just four activities that we would like to include on the budget side. Mr. Chair, my apologies. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Hatch. We do have time for a few questions, in spite of your lengthy presentation. So I'm going to just start out with a couple of comments. You know, you've made a number of requests, come forward with a number of proposals for revenue increases. Is there anything you know, nobody ever comes to us and says, well, we've got this program that has kind of seen its time and we could get rid of it. Do we have any of those choices?
Well, Mr. Chair, members, I think that we've been able to make progress by becoming more efficient. So in a way, we have been able to find ways to save funds, but that really adds additional funding for a lot of these operations areas as well as our state road construction program. So to the extent we've actually done projects that we otherwise didn't have in our plans, that's an example of where we've kind of, you know, saved money. So we're always looking for ways to either sunset or to find a different way to do our program, and we're kind of regularly doing that. Everything from adding a tow plow to save a truck. You know, we still have an aging fleet, but we now actually have the need for a smaller fleet than we did before. So that's an example.
Thank you. Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks for your presentation. You know, these delayed infrastructure projects don't go away. They just get more expensive. And I'm wondering, have you been able to quantify what this these continued delays in terms of our putting off a comprehensive transportation package to get at the $600 million a year? What does it cost when we don't act on this? Do you have a rough figure, or can you provide that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hornstein, thank you for the question. I think the top line answer would be our new state highway investment plan, which is a 20-year outlook. We really determined that gap to be $18 billion, whereas 4 years ago, when we did the same assessment, it was a $12 billion shortfall. Now, part of that is because we're looking forward to another 4 years, but we're looking back at 4 years when we haven't really done anything to fill those gaps. So there's a combination of more expensive projects, cost of inflation, and additional deterioration. So I don't know if you could add to that, but that's a pretty tangible measure.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Well, thank you, Representative. Well, thank you, Commissioner. Thank you, Deputy Commissioner. We appreciate your presenting the Governor's perspective on these issues, and we look forward to working with you as we proceed to assemble a bill in the fairly near future. So stay tuned, and thank you again for coming.
We'll be here.
Today.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Next, we have a Kelly Fenton bill, House File 135. Welcome to the Transportation Committee, Representative Fenton. This bill is to be laid over, so please go ahead with your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. I want to thank you for the opportunity to present House File 135. This is the I-94 interchange. It's 494-694 interchange system at I-94, and this is located in the East Metro in Woodbury. So this is one of the most highly traveled interchanges in areas in the second most traveled interchange in the state of Minnesota. So this basically is the gateway to the Twin Cities from the eastern United States and is a critical piece of infrastructure in the area. As you're going to hear in the following testimony, the current design of this simply does not serve our region well. Congestion and crashes with backups of nearly a mile are common. As a matter of fact, the chief author of this bill in the Senate's daughter was in an accident at this interchange. I'm willing to bet if you are in here and you're familiar with this, that you yourself or you know others that have literally driven out of their way to avoid this same interchange. So a new interchange is needed, and that is what this bill does. It directs the Minnesota Department of Transportation to develop a plan for the future. And I just will say, when I initially dropped, and I want to thank the Department of Transportation, when I initially dropped this bill, there was no plan at all. Currently, they're going to be making an investment in what I would say is a patch to this interchange, and this study is about the long-term future and how can we do this right for the safety of anybody who uses this. So I have Stan Kowalski with me, is the Washington County Commissioner, and I'm going to turn it over to him. Thank you.
Please introduce yourself for the record and go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Stan Kowalski, Washington County Commissioner, District 2, where this interchange resides. The importance of the interchange, this interchange is the first key decision point for vehicles entering our state on I-94 from the east. Using this interchange, vehicles and freight and commerce can access the entire South Metro area via 494, access the entire North Metro area via 694, and access the heart of the Twin Cities via I-94. The problems is in the design. The interchange was designed in the 1960s. Traffic volumes were a fraction of what they are today. The cloverleaf design served our region well, but now is outdated. Traffic safety. Over the last 5 years, there has been 517 crashes. The trend of these crashes are increasing. From 2011 to 2016, crashes have increased 45%. During this time, they have escalated from 85 crashes per year to 139 crashes per year during this time. This interchange design is outdated and simply does not accommodate the nearly 113,000 vehicles per day using this section of I-94, nor does it serve the East Metro area as it should. Other challenges related to the crashes are the interchange vehicle backup issues, which are involving Radio Drive to the east, 10th Street to the north, Tamarack to the south, and Century Avenue, also known as Highway 120 to the west, all a mile or less away. Century serves as the gateway headquarters to 3M and its 16,000 cars that park there each day. This interchange and vehicles approaching it is overly busy most hours of the day and including weekends. The short-term improvement, MnDOT does have a plan to widen and add lanes. Planned construction is for 2019. This will improve the interchange in the short term. We applaud MnDOT for acknowledging the importance of this interchange to the East Metro and the Twin Cities region. This is not a long-term solution. These improvements are simply a band-aid and not a cure. What we need is a new vision for this interchange, a plan beyond the short-term improvement, a plan that will serve us for the next 50 years or more. That is what House HF 135 does. It directs MnDOT to study, develop a vision, and a plan for the future that will accommodate growth and development in the East Metro. My personal interchange history, my entire life has been spent on the east side of town. The last 29 years in Oakdale, using this interchange twice a day. Prior to becoming a commissioner, I served 14 years on the Oakdale City Council and also as mayor, visioning this interchange at the time strategically for growth and safety. I also testified with Representative Fenton here 2 years ago. In conclusion, without a vision, we cannot continue to grow our region. We won't be able to attract new jobs and businesses. We won't be able to serve our existing businesses like the worldwide headquarters of 3M. Washington County and our local communities are ready to join with MnDOT in developing the vision. We are ready to get to work. We ask your support of HF 135. Thank you for your time and opportunity to discuss this important interchange with you today. I am happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Commissioner. We have a question from Representative Hausman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, I should know this map, but the Gateway Corridor, is that, will that take some of the relief off of this spot? Are they in the same corridor, or what's the
right
status?
You know,
Commissioner Sandberg.
We hope that will be part of the plan study, but that's in conjunction with the Gold Line Corridor. Gold Line Corridor is to really to handle future growth along that corridor. So I think there are two different needs, but yes, I think the study should incorporate them both working in harmony.
And Mr. Chair, just follow up. I'm assuming that the Gateway, now it's named a color, right?
Yes, Gold Line.
When they did their early study, they must have done some of the traffic studies also when they were anticipating.
Commissioner Sandberg, we have a habit around here working through the chair. So.
Mr. Chair, this is Commissioner Kowalski.
Oh, I'm sorry. I was on the wrong spot. Well, Commissioner Kowalski, I apologize. I gave you the wrong name. I didn't want to change your nationality or anything. Representative Kowalski.
People can't pronounce my name.
So. Yeah, well, I have the same issue once in a while. So, Commissioner Kowalski, just go ahead and answer the question.
Okay. Thank you, Mr.
If you can remember it now after all my blabbering.
I know that I am an alternate to the Gold Line Gateway Corridor, and I know on the early study there were extensive studies of the long-range transportation travel counts and the future of I-94 into that study, and that's why they justified the rapid bus line over the light rail system. And also we will be incorporating all sorts of future transportation into our plans in the Washington County. Hopefully that answers your question.
Thank you, Commissioner. I believe we do have another question from Representative Mason.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, I used to have a son that lived in Woodbury, and I know I was always very conscious of the time that I would go over there so I wouldn't be stuck in traffic. And with your long history, you know that MnDOT has been telling us that all they do is have money to do prevention. So we would like them to be doing long-term work here, and the question is, do you know, and it sounds like you should, that are all of the representatives and senators from your area prepared to vote for a comprehensive transportation bill?
Commissioner Kowalski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Committee. As far as I know, they're all solidly on board. We met with our legislative delegation, so I really think we have strong support. I'm not privy to their exact standing on each transportation issue at this time, though.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Now I believe we have Mr. Sandberg, or not?
Mr. Bradford.
Boy, I'm just having a heck of a time. Mr. Bradford, please identify yourself for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm John Bradford. I'm the city engineer for the city of Woodbury. And I must say it's refreshing to have the elected persons giving the technical data. And I can talk a little bit more about vision and moving forward. As the representative suggested, MnDOT has said that they've only got money for doing maintenance items into the future. And that's one of the reasons that we're here today, is that we feel that there is a real need to identify what the long-term vision is for this interchange. We can begin to identify what the costs are and how do we move forward to make sure that we've got a vital east side of the metro area. As Representative Henson said, this is the gateway to the east metro from Wisconsin and all parts east. And it's important that we're intentional in how we build this interchange. We were very fortunate to get early money in the 60s to build this interchange, but the downside of that is that it's old technology, and engineers learned a lot better on how to manage traffic through these as we move forward. And we're now at a stage where we need to expand and we need to update this infrastructure. I, too, want to thank the MnDOT for doing the significant investment in doing the interim upgrades to this interchange. We think it's a significant safety improvement, and we look forward to working with MnDOT on really a large-scale visioning study so that the community can move forward with this project.
Well, thank you, Mr. Bradford. I don't see any other questions. Any closing remarks, Representative Fenton?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members, and I think as you've heard, this is an important...
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but Representative Rosenthal does have a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Fenton, I truly sympathize with you, and it's a huge need. The first and worst tie-up in the metro, it affects my communities, and that's the I-5-494-35W interchange. And, you know, that is backed up every hour of every day, and it's a hazard, and there's accidents all the time. And so while I sympathize to yours, ours is the 17th worst in the country, and it not only affects Bloomington and Edina and Eden Prairie and all the way south, it also goes west. It goes in all directions. So I hope as we continue to talk about this, we don't forget about this project because it's very important, and it's in this committee, I believe.
Thank you, Representative Rosenthal. Now, Representative Fenton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. And I completely understand what Representative Rosenthal's comments are. I too, have driven past there at different hours, so I also sympathize. And I think as we've heard today that there's a huge need as the East Metro continues to grow in population, and this is one of the main corridors of commerce as well, with being just over the border in from another state. So I appreciate your time today, and I ask for your support. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative Fenton. House File 135 is laid over. Next, we have House File 1358, Representative Baker.
What are we doing? Laying it over. That's a little patient.
Welcome to, well, nice to see you at the testifiers table, Representative Baker, and your bill is being considered for possible consideration, so we'll be laying it over. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Today I bring you what's been kind of known as the Better Truck Initiative, the heavier weight truck. You heard earlier MnDOT is trying to find ways to be more efficient, be more proactive about how to build and maintain roads better and more efficient in the past. And I think this bill, when I decided to carry this, members, was something that's been in the works a number of years down here in the legislature. There has been some good collaborations, but it hasn't been enough to kind of get through some real tough hurdles to get over. I think that we've taken the bill this year and narrowed the focus a bit. We're really trying to focus on the aggregate part of this. It also includes construction materials. We're trying to really make sure we're focused on people that can carry gravel and cement and getting it to our projects around the state of Minnesota. Obviously, that's what this committee's focus is all about. So I do have an amendment, Mr. Chair. I'd like to be able to enter that as well. And our testifier can maybe speak to some of that, but it just really clarifies language for our local authorities that our counties and townships have always had some concerns about this bill, and I will tell you that you'll hear from them today too, but we are moving in a direction that I think is very collaborative, and we still don't necessarily have it perfect, but we're working towards that, and we'll hear more testimony about that as this moves on today, Mr. Chair. So I'll just ask that we enter the amendment as presented.
Thank you. Representative Baker moves the A3 amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye. Opposed. Your bill is amended. Introduce yourself for the record and go ahead.
Mr. Chair, thank you. My name is Fred Corey. I'm an executive director of the Aggregate and Ready Mix Association of Minnesota.
We appreciate the opportunity to speak to this bill. I believe there was a packet of information in your packet today. House File 1358 creates a new section in Chapter 169 of state statute related exclusively to authorizing special overweight permits for hauling construction material. The bill does not include any provisions related to existing truck weight statutes authorizing special overweight permits for hauling timber and agricultural products such as backhauls of agricultural projects. It preserves the authority of local government to route or deny permitted trucks on local roads and dedicates the revenues from permits issued under this section to the township bridge account. Construction materials means highway construction materials, building construction materials, and associated demolition materials. The bill does not change the current maximum 53-foot length limit for semi-trailers in Minnesota regulations. Permitted trucks must meet Federal Bridge Formula axle and tire weight limits. Revenues from the permits issued by the commissioner must be deposited in the town bridge account, in addition to the existing dedicated fees to local bridge inspections and posting costs that come from the timber and agriculture special overweight permit fees. Mr. Chair, I recognize this is the finance. We've been through the policy. So let me just talk briefly on what we believe the impact of this legislation could be. Permit fees for these construction materials, we're estimating anywhere from 500 to 1,000 trucks. For 500 trucks, that would generate approximately $200,000 a year. For 1,000 trucks, that could be up to $400,000 a year to the town bridge account. This is in addition to the current approximately 3,000 timber and agriculture permits that have been issued since 2008, generating more than $1,000 annually for bridge inspections and for costs of posting bridges under 10 tons. We also believe that there's savings of 2 to 4% on transportation project costs. Mr. Dunnick will talk a little more specifically about those costs. But we see it in a typical year, MnDOT spends about $100 million on reconstruction projects. The savings from these permits could be anywhere from $2 to $4 million a year. County and city construction projects are generally about $60 million a year, with savings of about from 1.2 to 2.4 million years. And lastly, the state does do significant bonding, typically in the neighborhood of $500 million a year. The savings from this bill could generate as much as $1 to $2 million a year in transportation costs to these projects. Mr. Chair, thank you. We appreciate your support on this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Corrigan. I'd like to remind members and guests that this bill has, as you mentioned, has been heard in the Policy Committee, so we'd like to kind of confine our remarks to the fiscal impacts of the bill. And we have a limited amount of time and a long list of testifiers, so I'm asking everyone to keep their testimony short and efficient as possible. Mr. Dunnick, welcome to committee. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Jason Dunnick, and I'm with Dunnick Companies. I'm here today representing Dunnick Companies. I'm also here today representing the Minnesota Asphalt Pavement Association. MAPA supports this legislation. Dunnick has a fleet of 6 to 7 axle trucks and hires about 20 to 25 more to satisfy our needs each day. Our safety record is one of the best in the industry, and we are very proud of our record. We train our drivers in advanced driving skills behind the wheel CTOT. This class consists of approximately 1 hour of classroom instruction and 5 hours of behind the wheel instruction. Makes the drivers aware of the vehicles and operating capacities and limitations. Dunnick does business in Minnesota, South Dakota, and North Dakota. And we find that South Dakota and North Dakota have already enacted the upper weight limits. Minnesota has not. In front of you today is a construction document that I brought along from Kanawha County. This job is from Clare City, Minnesota to Wilmer, Minnesota. On Truck Highway 23, the build results was $1,935,147. I have assessed the savings as a result of the increased load from 80,000 to 97,000 pounds. The two quantities that I'm working with today is bituminous at 24,111 tons and Millings at 23,027 tons. After calculating the numbers, the increased savings would have been about $84,972, or about $1.19 a ton mile. $84,972 is a savings translated to about 4.6% reduction in overall cost for that job. You also see today, the second document that I put in front of you, is that the reduction of haul trucks by 550 trucks for this job alone. This takes trucks off the road and reduces our carbon footprint and makes us more efficient all the way around. Dunick owns 7 ready-mix plants from Redwood Falls to Glenwood, Minnesota. We are finding that we're hauling aggregates further and further away from our facilities. If weight limits increase, this would be a significant savings to the end user. With that, I end my remarks. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Dunick. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Jim Loeffler, and I represent the Minnesota Asphalt Pavement Association. We represent 96% of all the producers, suppliers, and paving contractors in the asphalt industry in Minnesota. Our member companies provide thousands and thousands of good-paying jobs statewide. Well over 80% of the 2017 to 2020 STIP will involve asphalt pavements. I'm going to be very brief because I know we have a lot of testimony on both sides. Our organization strives to be cost conscious. Mm-hmm. We have to be because we are involved in a competitive bidding process for the public dollar. And so we consider ourselves good stewards of the taxpaying public. Our members support the provisions of House File 1358 because this will have the practical effect for our members of reducing the number of trucks hauling to each job site. That efficiency will translate ultimately into savings for Minnesota taxpayers. Thank you very much.
Thank you. If you want to just stay put for a second, Mr. Loeffler, Representative Salk had a question. I don't know if it's to you or to
I think yourself or the previous testifier. When we're dealing with this cost and then the calculation toward theoretical savings coming, one of the things is just my practical life. I have lived for a number of years on a road that drives by the entry point from an asphalt company. And so as they, in Rochester, we're fairly dynamic right now in road building and that sort of thing, and a lot of asphalt goes through that one stoplight at West Circle, West River Drive and 37th Street, which causes 37th Street to become pretty much a new shaped road after the season. And so there is a fairly significant amount of maintenance that the city has to come back and do, and or reconstruction that has to be done. And I know that that is replicated every single time there's an entry point, because, you know, I'm just a farm kid, but I can tell you, you drive that heavy stuff and you put it on a stress, which is while you're coming out, that asphalt, that base is all under much more stress than when the product is rolling down the road. Plus, it's going to happen the same way every time that route of carry is going around a 90-degree turn, almost except for probably entry points to a superhighway, where most of those are eased off. So I'm just wondering about, you know, it sounds like a really nice number to, okay, we'll save this, but we have residual costs that are also part of the process. And I think there is, I know that somebody could say, well, there's fewer trucks, so that might mean less damage, but I'm not certain that, I just don't know where that calculation goes. But I can tell you I can see it. So if you could help me understand how that calculation balances out and or if that's somehow factored into this.
Mr. Dunnett.
Mr. Chair, Representative, are you asking me about more axles and truck weights on the axle, or are you asking me how that gets paid for?
I'm commenting on your, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair.
Representative Sal.
I'm asking for a better way of understanding the cost savings
without, in so far I didn't think you enumerated the cost expense of what's happening when larger weight vehicles, whether with axles or not, but when they're turning onto, particularly on asphalt, throughways and highways, but even on concrete, they get rolled when that series of trucks spends a full construction season coming through those things. And I think more weight creates more disturbance to the residual roadways. And so I'm putting in question whether there's really a savings or if we're just succeeding in getting bigger trucks and fewer runs, but we're ending up with just a transfer of the benefit of maybe a lower bid, which then drives up the base cost of maintenance for the county systems, the city systems, and the other ones that end up having to kind of come back and patch up their road system.
Mr. Dunning.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'm not an engineer, but I'll try this.
Well, I understand that. I don't even know you're going to have a number. I'm just asking.
More axles on the truck have less PSI on the road is what we have been told, or what I have been told, and I believe that's correct. However, you do have turning radiuses that do get squashed, and in statute 169-88, there is statute for damage liabilities to a contractor that is already in statute, and so I think that would address some of those issues if the road would get damaged, like other roads from an asphalt plant that are hauling the road.
Okay.
Does that answer your question?
Representative Salk.
Just one small follow-up, and I'm just a farm kid, so some of this stuff probably should make sense to somebody else. I've seen a lot of those trucks roll around corners like that, and then they pull up their wheels to get around the corner, to lay them back down, and then continue down the road where it's straight, and they aren't going to be pulling themselves around. And you know what I'm talking about. They're basically, if the wheels are down, they're scraping their way around because the turning radiuses don't work anymore.
Mr. Dunn.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I am not a truck driver, and I cannot answer that.
Well, we're going to hear from some truck drivers in a minute. So, gentlemen, save your words, please. Representative Bernardi has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is, Mr. Corrigan had mentioned that local authorities have the right to prevent a permit. I am searching through the amendment and through the bill trying to find where that language that allows that to happen.
Mr. Corrigan is approaching the stand.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair.
Would you repeat the question, please, Representative Bernardi?
That you mentioned that the local authority have the right to prevent a permit, and I'm looking through this language. Is there, so, and if you, I want to, it, can the local authority prevent this permit from happening? Do they have veto power? I thought somebody had mentioned that was the case. I'm sorry if I misunderstood.
Mr. Corrigan.
Representative, I can't talk to you about preventing a permit. I can talk to you about MnDOT has the authority to take a permit away from a truck that's not performing the way the permit was designed.
Okay, so Mr. Chair, I just want to make sure I understand this correctly. So a local does not have the authority to veto a permit? Is that correct?
Mr. Corrigan or Representative Baker, perhaps.
Maybe I'll take a stab at this, Mr. Chair and Representative. I think, as I understand this, is that, and again, that's part of our working very closely with the counties and the townships. I don't think they have the ability to deny a permit if there's a project coming. They have local authority to say where the rural, the haul route will be. They absolutely have that authority. So they will post the roads. They will approve the roads with companies like Dunnex ahead of time. So when Dunnex actually does a project in those areas, they're going to ask for that raw haul ahead of time, that haul route, so that they make sure they know how to get the product from point A to point B. So the local authorities have that authority. I don't think they have the ability to deny the permit, but just to make sure they have that authority to approve that haul route.
Thank you. I'm going to move on to Mr. Evans.
Thank you.
welcome to the committee, and please introduce yourself for the record and go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is John Appitz. I'm with the law firm of Messerly and Kramer, and you've seen me here before, and likely you'll see me here again. This seems to be an annual rite of the legislative passage. So for those of you who's heard this before, this is a refresher, and get ready with the arguments, because the next group coming along will ask for another exception of another kind. We kind of do this annually, so pay attention. We'll talk about highway weight limits. With me is Tina Ryberg with the Twin Cities and Western Railroad. I'll let her introduce herself briefly, and I know our time is limited, but she represents the railroad industry, if you will, today, particularly the short line industry, and the short line industry is the one that's going to be impacted by this. These are the short line railroads that operate in the communities, the 20 of them that operate in the communities across Minnesota. Let me be respectful of your time, introduce Ms. Ryberg, and I'll have a couple of comments when we close.
Please introduce yourself for the record. Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, I'm Tina Ryberg. I'm the administration manager of the Twin Cities and Western Railroad and the Minnesota Prairie Line. The reason I'm here testifying in opposition is this is really an economic issue for the Twin Cities and Western Railroad and also the many other small businesses that operate short line railroads here in Minnesota. I appreciate the opportunity to share the consequences of voting to increase the weights of trucks operating on our state roads. In short, increasing truck weights will reduce the amount of freight shipped by rail and increase the amount shipped by truck. Increasing truck weights will increase the damage to and maintenance costs of our public roads and bridges. One car does not equal one truck, even if you increase the weight limits. A rail car has four times the capacity of a truck. So every 100 rail cars diverted from our tracks equals 400 additional trucks on the roads, forcing taxpayers to pick up the tab for increased road maintenance and roadway congestion. And moving freight by rail is the most environmentally sound way to move goods over land. According to an independent study for the Federal Railroad Administration, railroads, on average, are four times more fuel efficient than trucks. A lot of our aggregates, the shipments come from western Minnesota towards and into the Twin Cities. So increasing truck weights does not mean less trucks. It means the diversion of hundreds, if not thousands, of additional trucks onto our highways. And that's just our rail line alone. We are not like the large Class 1 railroads. We are a small short line railroad that provides freight transportation services to rural businesses and communities in greater Minnesota. The freight traffic that would be diverted from rail to truck is the type hauled by our relatively small railroad. Twin Cities and Western Railroad hauls hundreds of rail cars of aggregates annually. And that is only one of the construction materials that this bill will allow and heavier trucks. The transportation of aggregates is very competitive, and if you allow heavier trucks, that will tilt the competitive balance between railroads and trucks in favor of trucks, putting Twin Cities and Western Railroad and the Minnesota Prairie Line at risk of losing that business and the related freight revenues, which we reinvest in our business. A lot of this business would result in fewer dollars available to maintain and strengthen rail infrastructure, which is needed to support rail freight transportation services in rural Minnesota. From our short line perspective, we don't want this important rail freight diverted to the roads and onto taxpayer shoulders. We want to keep it on the rails and on our privately funded infrastructure that supports rail freight transportation services to our many customers and the communities that we serve in rural Minnesota. So on behalf of the Twin Cities and Western Railroad and the Minnesota Prairie Line, please don't vote to increase truck weights here in Minnesota.
Thank you, Ms. Ryberg. Representative Hornstein, did you have a question?
I'll wait till after Mr. Abbott.
Thank you. Representative Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And it's Ms. Breideck, right?
Ryberg.
This is a misspelling here. I'm totally on the wrong person. I apologize.
It's kind of been happening all day today, Carmen.
There, I just used up all my time, didn't I, Mr. Chair? So if you would educate me. I'm not the industry expert, but I'm using, for example, like Mr. Dunnick's example of the Highway 23 project and other projects where aggregates and what therefore are going to these road projects. Does rail deliver to those projects? I guess I don't quite understand how aggregates go from rail to like a Highway 23 project. So are you, how many projects do you typically deliver to, and what are kind of those locations? I guess I'm not understanding how that works, if this is going to take away from rail work.
Mr. Chair, Representative.
Ms. Reichard.
To answer your question, and pardon me, I don't do this for a living, so I'm a little bit nervous here, but for our short line railroad, we haul 500 to 600 rail cars of aggregates a year, and it goes from a plant out in Ortonville, Minnesota, and it goes towards the Twin Cities. So we have locations in Glencoe, Minnesota, that's then transported from Glencoe to Hutchinson. We have some that go into the Twin Cities, into the New Brighton facility for Red Mix facility. I hope that answers your question. So that 500 to 600 rail cars would terminate, and they go all along our line.
Okay, just
a quick follow-up, President Miller.
Thank you,
Mr.
Chair. And I won't direct this back towards you, but I guess what I'm going to need is some clarification, because I'm hearing still the aggregates and I'm hearing stuff like this that are going to the project sites. It seems like we're talking about two different things, so if someone could clarify to me
offline, that would be helpful.
That would be just fine. Thank you, Representative Miller. Mr. Appitz, you want to wrap up this
presentation? Sure. Very quickly, and to Representative Miller, Mr. Chairman, Representative Miller's question. Take a look at the definition. We're talking about construction materials. Aggregates is one of those materials, but it's not limited to. It says construction materials, not limited to, and then enumerates a number of things. There's a whole variety of stuff that could be construction materials that could move. Some of it's going to come off of TC&W. Minnesota Northern Lines Rail, and a variety of others. Let me, if I could, just real quickly, Mr. Chairman, I drew an analogy the other day that I think might be a little bit useful to get your hands around this. Your car goes 100 miles an hour. Some of you may have gone 100 miles an hour in a car on occasion, but we don't go 100 miles an hour in a car just because we can. And why don't you do that? Because it's not safe. Bottom line, it's not safe. And heavier trucks, bottom line, are not safe. You stack them higher, which makes them more susceptible to rollover. There's more brake maintenance issues. There's plenty of studies to indicate this. And they cause more severe impacts. Everybody understands physics, more severe impacts when they're involved in an accident. Law enforcement does not like this proposal. Generally speaking, look at the materials we put before you. And yes, we have 10-ton roads, but just because somebody wants to put 10 tons on them doesn't necessarily mean that's the best idea. It doesn't necessarily make sense. And we got to the issue about bridges very briefly. Bridges across this nation are in bad shape, and bridges, there's about 1,500 bridges in Minnesota. They're either structurally deficient or functionally, I don't remember all the terms, but they're not in good shape. It doesn't matter how many axles you put under a truck. When you put it all on a bridge, that weight imposes itself. Last year, the USDOT said, let's not have any more increase in truck weights. I'm just suggesting to you that that might be good advice. We oppose this bill, and we hope that you give the short lines and your roads a break.
Representative Jaskowski.
Okay. Pass, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hornstein.
Thanks, Mr. Chair, and I have just a couple quick questions for Mr. Appitz. You know, you cited that USDOT study, and, you know, I mean, it's pretty clear, 400% higher crash rates in Michigan since heavier trucks, 99% additional in Idaho. But I think to Representative Stout's earlier questions, where I think he was trying to get at the cost, since this is a finance committee, the additional costs of having heavier trucks. And so what would be some examples in your mind, Mr. Appitz, that, you know, that could drive up our overall public and private costs if this were to prevail?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hornstein, I think the most telling note is this. Out of a Norberg study that was done about 7 or 8 years ago, indicated that as you increase the weight of trucks, the cost of the damage that's done is not paid for by that increased weight. A truck that runs at 80,000 pounds pays for about 80% of the damage that's done.
A truck at 97,000 pounds pays for less than half of the damage that it does to the pavement and the bridges. So I can't give you much better than that, but I think that makes the point.
Representative Hornstein.
And then, Mr. Abbott, I mean, and I think there are some compelling letters that we have from law enforcement, but there would be some additional, safety costs, I assume, incurred by this as well if we're having these higher crash rates. Do you have a sense of what those might be?
One of the things, Mr. Chairman, that you might note, the money that is from the $300 and $500 fees that go to pay for the increased costs or to go to an account that allows townships and counties to basically downscale the weight, to post the bridges down so they don't have the sort of impact on them. That'll be one of the impacts, and I don't know how $300 is going to pay for the amount of impacting that it's done. And you've got increased costs for weighing these, for keeping track of this. I think the question of what's being carried in this is what these trucks that are construction material are going to raise some interesting questions about how that is enforced by State Patrol and others as well.
So thank you, Mr. Chair. So I guess, you know, the bottom line is that there is a pretty big bottom line to this, and I hope that, we can get some more data about the costs that we'll all incur, you know, if this were to move forward.
Thank you. I have some questions on the list, but I'm going to move on to the Teamsters right now. We're very short of time, folks. Welcome to the Transportation Committee. Please identify yourselves for the record and go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Edward Reynoso. I'm the political director for Teamsters Joint Council 32. We represent a nexus of 62,000 active and retired members in the state of Minnesota, many of which are truck drivers and would be severely impacted by this legislation. Now, I've already testified in the prior committee, and I know I've spoken to many of you individually. And so I felt it would probably be better than to hear from individuals that will actually be driving these trucks, individuals that actually drive these trucks. As Mr. Dunnick had mentioned, he's not a truck driver. These people are. They're going to tell you what their experiences have been with safety. And in fact, I would like to introduce the first gentleman that's going to come up is John Baumgartner. John Baumgartner has a 5 million mile safety driving award. Now, 5 million miles, that's to the moon and back 10 times. So that's an exorbitant amount of mileage that he has under his belt for safety, and he's got the awards right here to prove it. So I'm hoping that they provide a very brief interaction with this committee on what they believe would be detrimental to our safety system, for our general public, and for them, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome to committee. Please identify yourself and go ahead.
My name is John Baumgartner. I'll tell you right now, I'm very nervous. I'm not as good looking as all of you. I don't have a tie. I don't have good shirts, but the gentleman that talked before me is very honest. I do have 5 million miles. Here's plaques that I have it. I've proved it. I've done it. Safety's been my goal. You can pass them around if you'd like. Safety's been my goal. And I have something that I'd like to just read off to all of you. And think about what you're driving your car.
Don't be nervous, Mr. Baumgartner. You.
We've all made our mistakes today, so I'm going to make some.
You're very good looking. You have quite a, bit.
I can fit right in with you.
You have quite a bit more hair than the chair, so you're doing great.
Thank you. Good afternoon, members of the committee. My name is John Baumgartner, and while earlier today listening to various people telling you that adding 17,000 pounds to trucks will make it no difference, I can assure you that none of them have true experience and acknowledge of the real-world consequences increasing the maximum truck weight in Minnesota as I do. As a 40-plus year Teamster and a lifelong truck driving with over 5 million miles of safe driving, I know firsthand what an impact will do to the one and only issue that matters to me, and that is safety. Safety to all of you, even when you drive your cars, ladies and gentlemen. If you missed that, yes, I said 5 million miles of safe driving, which is almost from here to the moon and back 10 times. John Glenn had nothing on me. I started driving a truck in 1964, so yes, over 40 years without a chargeable accident. As a professional, there is nothing more important to me than safety, not only for myself, but to you as the general public. While people testify in supporting heavy trucks, none of their information includes the men and women that would be driving the equipment, the trucks, drivers themselves. Even the study that has been cited today, the 206M Minnesota DOT study, left the most important input out. Us, the drivers, nor did they even consider including our labor union, the Teamsters, in the process. Maybe that was done intentionally because they didn't want to hear what us drivers thought of it. Who knows? As a driver, I personally know through my experiences that it's very rare the truck driver that causes an accident is most times then not a driver of a small vehicle cutting us off or coming to a sudden swerve or stop. I know today you have heard various people argue that there won't be an impact to braking distance. Well, I have to say, there is a lot of difference in that. I'm telling you my opinion as a driver and as a professional driver. Experiences are crowded and sometimes potholes infested road systems that bring these trucks with the added weights to a sudden stop will be much more difficult, especially on our icy Minnesota roads. Accidents happen in an incident, and that small time frame allows for little to no mistakes to sometimes effort. My first mistake, I can't pronounce the word. Added weights to the truck will comply that on so many levels. There is one study that did take place in 2013, and in this study, there were drivers and other stakeholders involved. In the study, when the truck drivers were asked their opinion on various issues, such as braking distance and other safety concerns, the outcome of the study with drivers' input was a different outcome. Why? Because we are the men and the women that will be actually asked to drive this equipment. Why? Because we know how difficult our roads are at times, and we know how real-life situations happen on our roads. As a 40-plus year experienced driver, I ask that you strongly consider joining the Teamster Union in opposition to House Field 1358. Thank you for your time. I made it short, and I appreciate your attention.
Thank you, Mr. Bumgarner. We're glad you'd be with us, and thank you for your safe driving record. We all appreciate it.
Well, thank you.
We're already over time, folks. I'm going to take a couple quick questions from representatives. Mr. Reynoso, can we cut your folks' testimony off at this point?
Would that be okay, Mr.
Okay, let's take a couple questions and one more minute for the Teamsters. Representative Barr, was your question at this point?
I just wanted to comment on the study.
Very quickly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've heard a number of folks here today reference the USDOT study, and we have a number of data points in our packet today. And the one thing I wanted to point out, because I'm always a little skeptical of data, is that some of the references are being made to trucks with much larger weight sizes than what we're talking about here. And there's also, right in the DOT's study itself, it says that the analysis of crash rates cannot be extended to other states or used to draw meaningful conclusions on a national basis. And I just wanted to point it out because I know we have a lot of data that we're trying to sift through. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Barr. Representative Sundin, a quick question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To Mr. Baumgartner, I was just wondering if you'd give us a quick history lesson, or I'm going to share something with you. About 10 years ago, there was a surge in road construction up north there, and I saw this truck, and I had to stop and talk to the road foreman there, and I said, "Hey, Cal, what the heck is that thing?" He says, "That's a 1961 Diamond Rio. They were that short on the truck." Now, you might be familiar with that truck.
Yes, I am.
Okay. If you started overloading some of these trucks, that thing's probably retired by now. But some of this aging fleet of trucks, is it going to get worse or worse or worse or better, better, better?
That's a very
Mr. Baumgartner. Go ahead.
That's a very good question. I'm hoping that it'll get better and better, because if everybody takes an interest in safety, it'll get better and better.
Very quickly, Representative Sundin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to point out to members here that on page 1 of the bill, 1.8, it refers to building construction materials and demolition materials. So this isn't limited to road construction. We have landfills all over the state and taking demolition materials, and we have retailers that are delivering building construction materials all over the place. So this bill is a little bit bigger than what it appears to be.
Thank you, Representative. One quick minute for the Teamsters, and we're moving on.
Mr. Chair, I'd just like to expand a little bit on Representative Barr's question, or comment, should I say. Mr. Chair, through the Chair, Representative Barr, you're absolutely right. It doesn't have enough information and evidence, and in fact, the MAP 21 study specifically said that there's not enough information available with crash results, with fatality rates, and long-term impact to roads and bridges, that they recommend that states not go forward with a weight increase because of that, because there's not enough information. So with that, Mr. Chair, just our last speaker.
Very, very short.
Good afternoon. My name is Mark Fiskins. I've been a truck driver and a local Teamster for the last 28 years, ready mix driver for the last 18. I'm here today to oppose the weight limit. I drive 25 to 30,000 miles a year locally. And I have witnessed the tragedy that comes with driving big and heavy trucks, damage to roads, eroding shoulders, and depleting bridges, accidents, and rollovers. Safety is an everyday concern of our Teamsters drivers, as it is ultimately us that is responsible for the truck at the end of the day.
Thank you. I'm sorry to cut you off, sir, but if we don't finish this up in the next minute, we're going to be back at 11 o'clock tonight.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. We'll hear quickly from the counties. If we can be done by 5-2, then we will actually be able to adjourn. Otherwise, we're back after session.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you. My name is Wayne Sandberg. I'm the Washington County Engineer. And basically, first I want to thank Representative Baker for reaching out to us. He did work with us. But I do want to reference Representative Sock's comments. You really encapsulate our concerns. Not every road, gravel or paved, is appropriate for these large trucks. And this bill, as written, completely excludes local government officials, county commissioners, county engineers, township officials, from managing where these trucks go. Yet they're the same people that have to raise taxes to pay for the damage that these trucks are going to do. So we can't support this bill as written. It removes our permit authority and our ability to control the routes where these go completely. If that would be reinstated somehow, we might be able to support a bill like this, but as written, we cannot support this. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, John Bradford again, City of Woodbury Engineer. I too would represent the comments that support the comments that Mr. Sandberg gave. There is also a whole host of staff costs that hasn't been brought up in this. The MnDOT giving a permit or a provisional permit, then the city's going through a process to approve or decline, going back to MnDOT, coming back to the cities, going to the permit holder. I think that there's a big inefficiency in government in doing that. When Woodbury is giving out permits, we get a call from the hauler. They say we would like to haul to this location. We tell them what routes they can do. It's under 5 minutes. In most cases, the permits are free. We only charge a $25 fee when we are in the the spring thawing period. So I believe that we're introducing a whole lot of inefficiencies in government, and we all like to have an efficient government. That's all I'd like to say.
DOT, you've got the last word, and you've got about 1 minute.
If you want to ask a question, we'll be back after 1 o'clock.
I just have one sentence.
DOT.
No question.
DOT.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Scott Peterson from NDOT. You've heard a lot of information here today, and this is the same conversation that has been repeated year after year for the last several years about this topic. And I went back and looked at my notes after testifying in the policy committee, and I came prepared to talk about what really is in the federal study, because 2 years ago that's what we were pointing to as something that would help us answer some of these questions. And what was stated here was actually true, was that the final conclusion of that is that there just really isn't enough information at this point in time. There's a lot of like isolated studies, but there's nothing that's compelling on any of the topics that you've heard about, whether it's safety or damage to pavement, damage to bridges, or the mode shift from trucks to trains. And so and the basis of that, we think it's premature at this point to move ahead with another carve-out, expanding the number of these heavy trucks that are on the road. And then the other final point I would just like to make very quickly is that the bill as amended puts a lot of responsibility on MnDOT to provide permits that affect local governments, that I think would change the fiscal note that we prepared on this bill. And so if we move forward with this bill, I think that we really need to pay attention to that. I'm not sure that MnDOT actually can fulfill the requirements that are put on it.
Thank you. Wrap up. Representative Baker.
Mr. Chair and Committee, thank you for the lecture time today. As I stated very early on, we're very committed to making sure the local roads and the local authority have this ability to say you can't drive on this road. My commitment is there. And if this is a big change in our policy with joining our other neighboring states, this is the time Minnesota needs to do this. We've got to be able to do these to make our roads more efficient, to build them more efficient. I'm committed, Mr. Chair, members, to make this happen, and I'll continue to work with the counties to make sure they have that authority that they're looking for. And with that, Mr. Chair, I thank you for laying this over.
Thank you, Representative Baker. Your bill is laid over. We are adjourned.